This is always a critical point of such conversations. I have to decide whether to commit myself to a long and painful exchange, or talk in ambiguities, euphemisms, and obscure technical language, and leave quickly, untouched and uncontaminated by the patient's suffering and illness. "I'm afraid it probably is," I replied. "Am I going to die?" he shouted back in mounting panic. "How long have I got?" He started to cry. "Maybe you've got 12 months," I blurted out, instantly regretting what I had said, and alarmed at his lack of restraint. I found it very difficult to console this fat, alcoholic, and pathetic man suddenly faced by his impending death. I knew that I was both awkward and inadequate. "I'm going to die in 12 months?" "Well," I said, "maybe. There is some hope. But you know what it is, don't you? You're a senior doc, aren't you? I'm going to die." "Well, I'm 90% certain, but we," I said, lapsing into the plural form so loved by policemen and bureaucrats and doctors, which absolves us from personal responsibility and relieves us of the awful burden of the first person singular, "we might be able to help with an operation." He cried and cried. "Have you got any family?" I asked, although I already knew the answer. "I'm all alone," he replied through his tears. "Any children?" "Yes." "Don't they want to come and see you, even now, when you're ill?" I asked, and once again immediately regretted it. "No." He burst into floods of tears again. I waited for him to stop, and we sat together in silence for a while. "So, you're all alone," I said.
"Yes," he said. "I used to work in a hospital, you know. I'm going to die there, aren't I? All the piss and shit. All I want is a cigarette. You just told me I'm going to die. I want a cigarette."
As he said this, he desperately mimed smoking a cigarette with his one good hand, as though his life depended on it. "You'll have to ask the nurses. Nobody is supposed to smoke anywhere here at all," I replied. I thought of all the no-smoking notices in the hospital and the huge posters that greet one on arrival at the hospital gates, saying in brutal black and red, "Put it out!" "I'll go and talk to the nurses," I said. I went to find a sympathetic staff nurse. "I've just told poor Mr. Mayhew he's going to die," I told her apologetically. "He's dying for a cigarette. Can you help?" She nodded quietly. When I later left the ward, as I walked down the corridor, I saw two of the nurses lifting him into a wheelchair. He was shouting as they manhandled him off his bed.
"He's just told me I'm going to die! I'm going to die! I don't want to die!"
There must be some secret place in the hospital where they can wheel the paralysed patients for a smoke. I was happy to know that common sense and kindness had not yet been completely beaten out of the nurses. 3 years ago, I built a roof extension in the attic of my house. I installed sloping skylights with French windows opening out onto a small enclosed balcony cut into the roof space at the back of my house, and around this I built a short balustrade. There is room for a single chair and a few pot plants, and I like to sit there in the summer evenings when I get home from work. So I sat there after returning from the hospital with a gin and tonic, with a typical South London vista of chimney pots and slate roofs and a few treetops stretching away from me into the distance. I could see the garden birds flitting in the fading light between the trees of the back gardens below me, and my 3 beehives in front of my workshop. I thought of my patients, I thought of my colleague, and of the man to whom I had just read out a death sentence. I thought of how he had immediately understood that he would never get home, that his estranged family would never visit him, that he would die in the care of strangers in some impersonal place. I thought of how I had walked away, but what else could I have done? As the sun set, I could hear a blackbird on the neighbouring roof singing its heart out. The three operations which I carried out next day were simple and straightforward. It turned out that the woman with the meningioma had been on one of the other wards on the Sunday evening after all. A few days later, after I had operated on the alcoholic Mr. Mayhew, and after he had been discharged from my ward, I saw him in the distance as I was coming into the hospital. A nurse was pushing him in a wheelchair towards the hospital coffee shop. He waved his good arm to me, and it was difficult to know if it was in greeting or in farewell. I did not see him again. Chapter 25. Anesthesia Dolorosa. Noun. Severe spontaneous pain occurring in an anesthetic area. It was the summer when I had broken my leg falling down the stairs. There had been a heat wave, which had come to an end with a brief thunderstorm early in the morning. I lay happily in bed, listening to the thunder rolling and crashing over the silent city. My plaster cast had been removed the day before, and replaced by a large plastic and Velcro inflatable boot that looked as though it belonged to an Imperial trooper from Star Wars. It was very clumsy, but at least I could walk again and take it off at night. It was strange to be reunited with my leg, and to see it again after 6 weeks' absence, encased as it had been in a fiberglass cast. I stroked my leg and rubbed it as I lay in bed, listening to the rain pouring down, and tried to make friends with it again. It was stiff, purple, and swollen, scarcely recognisable, and felt oddly detached from me. Recent neuroscientific research has shown that even within a few days of a limb being lost or immobilised, the brain starts to rewire itself, with other areas of the brain taking over the redundant area for the lost or immobilised limb. My slight feeling of estrangement from my leg was almost certainly an aspect of this phenomenon. The phenomenon of neuroplasticity, whereby the brain is constantly changing itself. After a month off, I could now start cycling to work again, proudly displaying my Star Trooper boot to the passing traffic. This first day back at work was a Thursday, my outpatient day, so after the morning meeting I would be in the outpatient clinic. Once again, the SHOs at the morning meeting were new, and I did not recognise any of them. One of them presented the first case. "There was only one admission last night," he said, looking at the X-ray screen. "Not very interesting," he added. He was sprawled back in his chair, his back turned to us, trying to appear cool, but looking instead like an awkward teenager. "Don't ever say that," I said. "Who are you, by the way? And what do you want to be when you grow up?" A standard question I ask all the new doctors. "Orthopaedic surgeon," he told me. "Well, sit up straight and look us in the eye when you talk," I said. I told him that the progress of his medical career was going to depend largely on how well he presented himself and his cases at meetings like this one. I turned to the registrars and asked if they agreed, and they laughed in polite agreement. I told the chastened SHO to tell us about the patient admitted during the night. He turned a little sheepishly to face us. "This is a 72-year-old woman who collapsed at home." As he spoke, he fiddled with the keyboard in front of him, and a brain scan started to appear on the wall. "Hang on," I said. "Let's have a little more history before we look at the scan. Do we know her previous medical history? Was she fit and independent for her age? In what way did she collapse?" "Apparently she lived on her own and was self-caring and self-ambulating." "Self-catering as well," I asked, "and self-cleaning like an oven. Does she wipe her own bottom? Come on, speak English, don't talk like a manager. Are you trying to tell us that she looks after herself and can walk unaided?" "Yes," he replied. "So what happened?" "Her daughter found her on the floor when she went to visit her. It's not clear how long she'd been there." "So, what's the differential diagnosis for collapse in the elderly?" The new SHO reeled off a long list of causes and conditions. And where was she on the Glasgow coma scale? 5. Don't use numbers, they're meaningless. What was she actually doing? No eye opening to pain, no sounds and flexing. That's better, I said approvingly. I can actually see what she was like. Did she have a neurological deficit when you saw her last night on admission? He looked embarrassed. I didn't look. How did you know her coma scale then? I asked. It was